comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you happen to be, all around this beautiful place we call Earth, thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. I know you could be doing a million other things, but you chose to be here, and I appreciate that. I'm here because you have a right to know, and because you matter. We have a number of people who are new to the show each and every night. And as a result of that, they don't know that, we publish something called the K-Files. It's our free weekly newsletter. And it truly is free, no strings attached. And we would like to encourage you. I would like to encourage you, if you're not subscribed to it, get over to my website and subscribe. I don't know how to make it any easier. You just go to the website, and right in the middle of your screen, you see the word K-Files in great big letters, and you click it. And it's kind of amazing. Sometimes people are afraid to click something. You know, I saw that, but I didn't click it. Well, you got to click stuff when you go on the Internet. Guaranteed nothing will blow up. All right. And, so just click it and, subscribe. And then you'll start getting the K-Files. We start sending it out after the show on Friday nights. So if you subscribe right now, you'll get this week's K-Files. And, that's a cool thing. Now you do get, when you subscribe, you will get an email automatically. It's got a link in it that you have to click to activate your subscription. We do that to make sure that nobody but you can subscribe for you, okay? So we don't spam anybody. And I also want to let you know, if you're not aware of the fact, that this show is 100% member-supported, listener-supported. And you would think, with an audience in the millions around the world, that I'm probably just rolling in dough. And the fact is, I don't know any of you that could live on the budget I live on. And maybe you can, but I doubt it. And I don't know too many of you that would consider that that was even living. So I'm not rolling in dough. We barely make it from day to day. And that's because so many people around the world love the show, listen to the show, and, devil be damned if they are going to put a penny in it. Well, a few do, and they're paying for you to listen to that show tonight. How about you join us? It's only 25 cents a day, and no, we don't bill daily, okay? It's monthly, quarterly, or annually. So by the month, it's $7.50. And, but that comes out to 25 cents a day. You can't beat that. That is fantastic. You can't find anything at all like what we offer anywhere near that price. So, nobody but you can fix that now. You click where it says join and join tonight, and you'll be glad you did. And, you'll find there's a whole new universe in that members community. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back from this break, we'll be talking with Robert Morningstar. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is somebody who has been a guest many times on this show, but it's been a long time since he's been with us. Robert Morningstar, editor of UFO Digest, and we're delighted to have him back with us this evening. Robert, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Kevin.
I think we should let people know that the reason it's been so long is not because you didn't want to be here, and it's not because I didn't want you here, but you've been pretty busy with Coast Guard stuff, right?
Certain amount of it, yep.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of activity around New York as a result of the hurricane.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we're glad you're back with us, and you've got, I think, a fascinating topic for us to talk about tonight, at least for us to start off with. And it's a topic that I've done quite a number of broadcasts on, at least part of it, and that is the moon of Saturn called Titan.
Right.
You know, I used to broadcast from the Phoenix, Arizona area, and back then is when the Huygens probe landed on Titan, and it took those fascinating pictures.
Right.
And I did a show back then, a couple of shows, based on those pictures. And, you know, I said things that NASA seem to be, you know, oblivious to at first. Like, look, you can see rivers. You can see lakes. Look at that.
Point.
That's an ocean.
Good point. They just admitted rivers December 12th, 2012.
Mm-hmm.
A vast river system exists on Titan, which we'll get into a little bit later. Continue, please.
Well, I mean, I said, and that's an ocean. Look at that. I mean, how can you miss that, NASA? That's an ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I'm going to show a couple of those pictures to our TV audience tonight that I talked about back then. And, well, as a matter of fact, I'll just put one up right now. We'll come back to it. But we can see a coastline terminating in an ocean. And I did some zooms on. Now this is not one of the original photographs, folks. This is one off of a website, somebody else's website. But back then, I was getting the photographs as they were coming in, and you know, I did some zooms on it, and you could see what looks like construction. I'm going to show some things that look like construction tonight. That I've shown before.
I found a couple of unusual geometric forms on those photographs as well. It's remarkable that of all the planets and moons that we've studied, Titan, topographically speaking, is the most Earth-like of all of the moons and planets that we've seen, except for Mars, of course. I think it's equal to Mars. But the fact that it has water, ice, and methane oceans and rain, it's quite a remarkably dynamic atmosphere, which can be compared in many ways to Earth's, except that it's more based on methane activity than carbon.
Well, you know, you've heard me say this. If life happens, as evolutionists say, that, you know, given the right conditions, life just happens. Okay, given that, if that's true, if that's true, then it has to happen in the context of wherever it is. So life happens here primarily based on water and oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
On Titan, if this premise is true, then life happens primarily based on methane. And, you know, that should not seem strange to us. There are organisms here on this planet, on Earth, that will die if you expose them to oxygen. And that's on this planet.
Yep.
And they are living organisms. Mm-hmm. And so why would we think that you have to have oxygen? Why would we think you have to have water? when we have living things here that are allergic to those things.
You know, it's been 7 years since Huygens landed, and Cassini's still going around, making periodic approaches to Titan. So in 7 years, a lot has happened to reveal a very, very dynamic dynamic atmosphere. I get the impression from reading the NASA reports that Titan is fizzing, you know? It's percolating and it's fizzing, but at 290 degrees below zero. And the description of how hydrogen is being removed from the atmosphere and the inability to explain the mechanics of it bear greater attention to what's going on in Titan.
Well, let's do that. Let's dive into that.
A lot more than it's owned up to about life on other planets, visitations to Earth, UFOs, and Titan goes way, way back in UFO history, which we'll get into a bit later.
No, let's get into it now.
Okay. Well, everyone knows the name of Donald Menzel, the Harvard astronomer who was part of the Robertson Commission, along with Luis Alvarez, who was a specialist for Kodak. They were both members of the Robertson Commission on UFOs. And during that period of late 40s, immediately after Roswell and before Blue Book, there were two secret projects, Project Sign and Project Grudge, investigating Roswell material, UFO manifestations all over the United States and the world. And Project Sign came to the conclusion that, hey, we're being visited by extraterrestrials, though they called them things like celestials or celestians in those days, or interplanetary beings. And when this report, Project Sign report, got to Vandenberg, Hoyt Vandenberg, after whom the Air Force base is named, he said, no, no way, we can't have this. You're going to go out and, you know, and rewrite this thing. So then they put together another secret project, Project Grudge. Well, the point is that a lot of these documents were unearthed by John Greenwald in the Black Vault. And in his first Black Vault, I spent a lot of time there downloading tremendous numbers of files, CIA documents, Army intelligence documents. And amongst them, I found, of course, we know the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit report on the Roswell crash, this Project Sign report, Project Grudge, and there are two versions of the Blue Book report, one of which has a Chapter 13 and another one which is missing Chapter 13. That said, within the body of those documents, a story was told that the CIA enlisted Dr. Menzel and many of the top astronomers across the world, in fact, not just the United States. It happened that most of the great observatories of the time were in the United States and in Northern Europe. But they enlisted everyone. And they asked them to follow UFO fleets that were seen coming into Earth. The UFO fleets that I'm talking about are not the scout ships and regular flying saucers that were reported flying. For example, Kenneth Arnold's sighting of a squadron of 6 to 9. We're talking about motherships that took equatorial orbits and were like aircraft carriers. Actually, that's exactly what they are, because UFOs are aircraft. So interplanetary aircraft carriers, basically. It's a good description. So these things were seen coming and going. And ultimately, the astronomers concluded and reported that it seemed that the extraterrestrials that were piloting these ships had a base on Saturn's moon, Titan, which is one of the most remarkable observations, I think, in the history of astronomy.
Now, you're saying that there are formerly classified government documents that have this information in it, right?
Right.
And so people like Dr. Menzel were involved in gathering the data that produced those reports, those documents.
But did denying them to the, in public. He was always used as the most qualified and prestigious debunker of UFOs in the world of astronomy. A friend of mine pointed out, we were talking about Russian ufology, and it was Paul Stonehill, as a matter of fact, who wrote Soviet UFOs in Soviet Russia. And he pointed out that at the time that he was growing up, it was impossible for anyone to publish, Americans to publish books in Russia. But Donald Menzel's book, which debunked UFOs, had no trouble getting published in the Soviet Union. And Paul Stonehill's view is that the Soviet Union, like the United States, had a, had an interest in debunking UFOs to keep it out of the public domain and to keep it cosmic top secret as far as what they really were.
Why do you suspect they wanted to keep that a secret?
Excuse me?
Why do you suspect that the Soviets and Americans both wanted to keep that a secret when they had to understand there's no way you can keep a lid on this?
Well, you know, they did keep a lid on a lot of things, and they did have the apparatus to be able to do so in Soviet Union because the media was completely controlled. It was easier to do it there, I suppose, than to do it here.
Oh, they're controlled here too, Robert.
The directives of the CIA, the directives coming from the CIA to debunk, discredit, discredit witnesses, debunk the phenomenon, et cetera, et cetera, created the same climate in both countries. Now, why? Well, both of us, both countries were vying for world domination and to bring, which is an equation, right? U.S. versus Russia.
Mm-hmm.
We're working to each for our spheres of influence. To bring in another factor into the equation, which was overflying both countries with impunity and showed that the United States and Russia had no power to control this third power, this was not something that, that could be allowed into the public mind. And in particular, because of this antagonism between Russia or Soviet Union and the United States was generating the economic locomotive on planet Earth, what we call military-industrial complex in America.
Mm-hmm.
But this was driving both economies, and to admit that they were powerless in the face of another unknown presence, which could, as we know, fly over atomic bases, run circles around B-47s at 600 miles per hour. That was kind of a frightening thing to the people of the time.
But they concluded this this secret panel of astronomers that the CIA assembled. They concluded that these motherships were all headed back to Titan.
Yeah, that they described it as originating or have a base in on Titan. Now, you know, for we've been on together for many years, and you know, I've often mentioned that I don't believe the interstellar hypothesis of ET origins.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the interstellar hypothesis is one of the main ploys for denying their existence. The rationale being that the distances between stars are so great that it's impossible for anyone to cross them, even if they had the power of speed, faster than light speed, or speed of light velocities in their craft.
Whereas it's self-evident, if we can go to Titan, if we can,
now,
then
yeah,
certainly they could come here.
The Titanians could have been coming here for a long time. So that's my point about that. And as I've jested, I joke every once in a while with you, I say, I think ETs are local yokels, parallel evolution. Now, there was no weight to that argument or scientific evidence to support my argument of parallel evolution in within the solar system. We don't even have to leave the solar system, in my theory of ET origins. But there was no support for that. And this has changed radically with certain discoveries that have been made over the last couple of years. In particular, the fact that scientists have found the building blocks of life inside meteors and material of meteoric origins. So they cracked open meteors and they have found adenine and guanine, two of the building blocks of DNA. And now they've been studying the contents of interplanetary space, and they found water on Mercury.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel that these building blocks of life are actually floating in the cosmic winds, being carried by comets, cometary material, and meteorites that are carrying these and impacting and bringing the building blocks of life to all the planets. That in a sense, the building blocks of life are raining down or being dusted by cometary debris and meteors all over. So the idea of panspermia has gained a lot of weight over the last couple of years.
You know who John Lear is, right?
Of course.
Back then, when I say back then, it was in 2011. I had John Lear on the show. He's been here a number of times, but he was on the show in 2011 and made the statement that, first of all, there are 40 planets in our solar system, and we're not told about them. And you and I both know, because of the work you and I did in digging up information about the International Astronomical Union and their method of keeping information from people, and you dug up the report where they said they found some planets in our solar system and decided to suppress it. And so we know that there are planets they don't tell us about.
Yeah, they're very interesting. I would call them planetoids, and they're not right in the plane that the rest of the planets are. They're drifting off, and they have really interesting designations, like EO 1996, if I recall correct. But it's the year in which they're open, in which they're observed or discovered. And EO sounds to me like Earth-like object is the contraction.
Mm-hmm.
So I would advise people to start researching. I kind of stumbled on some of them using...
I hate to do it. We have to step away for break. We'll be back, ladies and gentlemen, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. This is Kevin Smith, and my guest this evening is Robert Morningstar. You know, as we went away for break, I had commented, Robert, that John Lear said there are about 40 planets, that there are 40 planets in our solar system, and we're not told about them. And he further said every single one of them is inhabited. What do you think?
Well, given this new proposition of the raining down of organic molecules and the building blocks of life and the dusting, basically, of the whole solar system, I don't find it far-fetched at all. Inhabited, you know, by anything from microbial life to intelligent organisms, some of them beyond our own intelligence. I don't find that hard to believe at all.
Okay, so let's get our focus back on Titan. NASA actually released a report about 2 years ago that pretty much says there's life on Titan without actually saying there's life on Titan, right?
Right. I have that here. And I'd like to, you know, go through it, you know, with a fine-tooth comb.
Okay.
With you.
All right.
And perhaps give our listeners a clearer idea of what is being described beneath all the jargon. The basic mystery is this, that the similar atmospheric processes... Do you want to say something?
No, I'm listening.
Similar atmospheric processes similar to those on Earth are occurring on basically on all the planets and moons that have atmospheres. The sunlight is striking the upper regions of those atmospheres and dissociating chemical bonds and releasing, creating new or free radicals. For example, on Earth, the ultraviolet light hits the upper atmosphere, knocking electrons off oxygen, so oxygen-free radicals or oxygen ions start floating around, and they tend to cause some problems for us. On Titan, the methane in the atmosphere being struck by ultraviolet light should be dissociating the methane into hydrogen and acetylene and several other hydrocarbons. But problem is, there should be an even distribution of hydrogen through the whole atmosphere, but Cassini discovered different densities of hydrogen and a hydrogen flow which is going basically in the wrong direction. Hydrogen being the lightest elements and the gravity of Titan being weak, it should float off, just go off into outer space. But they have found that there's a flow down to the surface of the planet, and the hydrogen is being removed. They use the word taken. It's being taken out of the atmosphere, which is an active process. You know, when something is taken, somebody took it or something took it. Well, the hypothesis is that hydrogen and acetylene may be the foodstuff of some methane-based life. They call it methanogenic life forms, hypothesized to be possible on Titan.
Well, in much the way that carbon dioxide is taken out of our air by, or a lot of it is taken out by plants.
Yeah, exactly.
Photosynthesis.
Analogy would be a space probe comes to Earth and they don't find enough carbon dioxide, and they say, well, where did all the carbon dioxide go? So then we would have to hypothesize that some organism or some planetary mechanism is extracting the carbon out of the atmosphere and consuming it. Well, this is about consumption. As a matter of fact, the article is called What is Consuming Hydrogen and Acetylene on Titan? You know, consumption just does have some connotations with ingestion. So, you know, the vocabulary being used is very interesting. So, do you want to go on?
Yeah, go ahead.
Other interesting things here.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Okay, we have the problem of methane-based organisms and what they would use as a substance, a medium. For it to move, it would generally have to be liquid in order to be able to flow or move, rather than being some kind of crystal, frozen crystal intelligence. But it's not water, so on Titan they have hypothesized that the liquid methane and ethane, which are copious and abundant and flowing everywhere, may be the medium for this new form of life. Now, the new hydrogen findings are consistent with conditions that could produce an exotic methane-based life form, but do not definitively prove its existence. That's a statement by a Cassini scientist, Darryl Sprouse, of Johns Hopkins University. Let me say that again. Quote, the new hydrogen findings are consistent with conditions that could produce an exotic methane-based life form, but do not definitively prove its existence. Those are pretty interesting words. Exotic?
Mm-hmm.
methane-based life form. And so they're talking around the subject, and a very interesting, at the end of, close to the end of the article, it talks about their scientific conservatism. Here's a quotation. Quote, "Scientific conservatism suggests that a biological explanation should be the last choice after all non-biological explanations are addressed," said Allen, the chief scientist. "We have a lot of work to do to rule out possible non-biological explanations. It is more likely that a chemical process without biology can explain these results, for example, reactions involving mineral catalysts. But they haven't found the mineral catalyst that they suppose is responsible." So they're looking for what could be interacting with this methane-based life form and consuming the hydrogen.
Well, I've got a problem with this chemical thing and chemical reaction. And with that statement, first the statement, that's not scientific conservatism, that's homoterocentricism.
That's fear.
This stuff is not exotic unless you're homoterocentric in your thinking.
Exactly, that's why I brought it up, Kevin. I need to catch the subtlety of the statement.
But then the chemical thing, here's the problem, though, with the chemical thing, Robert. The problem with the chemical theory of how this is happening is that all chemical reactions involve the emitting of energy or the ingestion of energy. That shows up in your infrared cameras. So this happening on a global basis on Titan would show up in the infrared analysis of Titan.
That may be. Here, listen to this statement, Strobel, because it's touching exactly on the subject you brought up about energy, energy dispersion and consumption. Strobel said that it is not likely that hydrogen is being stored in a cave or an underground space on Titan. The Titan surface is also so cold that a chemical process that involved a catalyst would be needed to convert hydrogen molecules and acetylene back to methane. Even though overall there would be a net release of energy, the energy barrier could be overcome if there were an unknown mineral acting as the catalyst on Titan's surface. So this mysterious catalyst, this mysterious mineral, they describe it in great details, but they have no idea of what it is.
Well, that's because it doesn't exist other than in their minds.
Perhaps.
No, it doesn't, because they can do... Okay, think of this thing logically. How do they know that's methane in the atmosphere? And how do they know there's acetylene in the atmosphere? And how do they know there's hydrogen? Because they're doing spectrographic analysis. So there ought to be something in their spectrographic analysis that they can't identify if there is this unknown mineral.
Yeah.
And there's nothing that they mention in their spectrograph.
They hypothesize it's got to be on the surface because it's not something that's happening in the atmosphere. The methane is being replenished very, very rapidly, so they... Again, they hypothesize that what they call cryovolcanoes that are erupting, are spewing methane into the atmosphere with water, liquid water coming out and flowing as lava would on Earth. But they haven't found any volcanoes like that.
No, and they have photographed, they've taken lots of photographs of the surface of Titan using Cassini. And, you know, their hypothesis that there's some unknown mineral doesn't match what we know of their equipment. Their equipment would have registered this mineral. Because, they have done scans of the surface and have talked about what the surface is made of.
Right. I'd like to talk about that now.
Okay.
If you don't mind, because this is... fantastic material. It's all in this NASA release on the consumption of hydrogen and acetylene on Titan.
Mm-hmm.
It says, in addition to Cassini spectrometer In addition, Cassini's spectrometer detected an absence of water ice on the Titan surface, but loads of benzene and another material, which appears to be an organic compound that scientists have not yet been able to identify. So they found the thing. They just don't know what it is. Okay, next. The findings lead scientists to believe that the organic compounds are shellacking over the water ice that makes up Titan's bedrock with a film of hydrocarbons at least a few millimeters to centimeters thick, but possibly much deeper in some places. The ice remains covered up even as liquid methane and ethane flow all over Titan's surface and fill up lakes and seas, much as liquid water does on Earth. So there's okay. this stuff, right? So they believe, they use the description of using a hose. What they found is a flow, you know, it's like a stream. It's a stream of hydrogen molecules. And the number is staggering. The number of the molecules that they've found is staggering. Strobel found a disparity in hydrogen densities that lead to a flow down to the surface at a rate of about 10,000 trillion hydrogen molecules per second. This is about the same rate at which the molecules escape out of the upper atmosphere. It's as if you have a hose and you're squirting hydrogen onto the ground, but it's disappearing, Strobel said. I didn't expect this result because molecular hydrogen is extremely chemically inert in the atmosphere, very light, buoyant. It should float to the top of the atmosphere and escape. So something is squirting hydrogen onto the surface, but it's not accumulating, it's disappearing. And the interesting thing about all of these discoveries through the instrumentation of Cassini and Huygens is that before these discoveries were made, Dr. Chris McKay hypothesized what a methanogenic life form would be like. And he said that hydrogen would be the most likely energy source, and acetylene would be an important element of what you might call a foodstuff, that methane-based life would most likely eat something that was based on hydrogen.
All right, we have to step away for break. We'll be back right after this. All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Robert Morningstar. We're talking about the possibility of life on Titan. And NASA has issued a report, actually a couple of years ago, it didn't get much play in the press, that walks right up to saying there is life, but then they back off and say, well, you know, scientific conservatism makes us have to consider everything else first. But, if I walk up and I see in a field and I see a dead deer and there's big chunks taken out of this dead deer, I don't have to consider some kind of something else happened. An animal ate this deer. I can see the results of it. So it's the report that says, well, scientific conservatism says that, some type of exotic life, we have to consider possible chemical processes, and exotic life would be the last consideration. If you're seeing it happen, then it's just happening. And, life not based on oxygen, life not based on water is not exotic. We have it on this planet. Right here on Terra, we have life that dies if you expose it to oxygen. And so it's not exotic, what that is, and it's not scientific conservatism. That is homo terracentric thinking. That's what that is. So let's call it what it is. And, I mean, it's okay if you want to be homo terracentric. That's okay. There's no law against it. But let's call it what it is. And so, Robert, you were talking about how they did the spectral analysis of the surface and found there was some organic material there that they couldn't identify, right?
Listen to this. Quote, in addition, Cassini's spectrometer detected an absence of water ice on the Titan surface, but loads of benzene and another material, which appears to be an organic compound that scientists have not yet been able to identify. And that's it right there.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that they've never seen before.
Well, perhaps. Look, they've seen methane, and it's there. They've seen hydrogen, it's there. They've seen acetylene, it's there. They've seen benzene, it's there. Okay, so they've seen all that stuff. What they haven't seen is life that thrives on that stuff. And I bet you this compound that they have found, and apparently a lot of it showed in their spectrometer, is that life.
That's what I'm saying as well.
Mm-hmm.
They're playing a word game here and running away from the discovery, you might say, because it's too frightening to the establishment.
All right, so let's go back to where we started, and this brings up some questions. We started out talking about these motherships that the CIA knew about back in the 1940s, and they asked astronomers, including Dr. Menzel, to sort of watch them, track them, and see what they could find out about them. And their report to the CIA was that they either originate from or have a base on Titan.
Exactly.
Okay, and so now we're talking about conditions on Titan being 290 degrees Fahrenheit minus 290 degrees Fahrenheit. We're talking about rivers and oceans of methane. We're talking about copious amounts of benzene on the surface. And then some kind of stuff that they can't figure out what it is. What does that say about the occupants of these motherships?
Well, would say to me that they're visiting Earth for some sort of research or resource, that they can't take the heat, basically, so they can't hang around for very long periods of time. And that any descent into our atmosphere would require them to employ some kind of super cold technology to make it possible for them to operate down here at the lower levels of the atmosphere. That's what I would say.
Even in Antarctica, it would seem tropical to them.
The very home, yeah. It's close. Yeah, it would seem tropical to them, but easier to handle, or the Arctic or Antarctica, but Antarctica being colder, that would be more favorable to such invaders, if you care to use the word.
So Mr. Freeze may actually exist.
Perhaps he does.
Yeah.
But here's another thing, Kevin. You know that one of the areas of study, deep study, that I've pursued has to do with alien abductions and ETAP, as well, and throughout history, and instances of ghost experiences, medieval witchcraft, demonology, all of these things. Very consistent story is that when the Middle Ages, let's say, an individual, witch, warlock, or an ordinary person had an encounter with the devil, it was an incredibly cold experience. They describe contact with a demon or a devil as icy cold, and would freeze the soul of the person. And in modern times, I've had the same report about encounters with extraterrestrials. And I always hearken back to Whitley Strieber's book, Communion. And what I consider a stroke of genius in his insights in Communion, where he hypothesizes that another dimension may exist on the other side of death, and that they may have a technology that makes it possible for them to travel here, either interdimensionals or ghosts. And you know that ETs often pull ghosts out of a hat when they abduct somebody to placate them or make them feel at ease or at home. They'll manifest an apparition of a departed loved one. So all these mysteries are all wrapped up, and I think that the super cold, the communion hypothesis of Whitley Strieber, that there may be a super cold technology that makes it possible to open up windows between the worlds or dimensions, may be a key element in resolving this mystery.
Well, it may be. Now, the thing is that when we're talking about that, we're talking about beings that would come from someplace like Titan.
Right.
If John Lear's statement is correct, that, you know, there's 40 planets and that they are all inhabited, if that's correct, well, conditions are different on all the planets. Mm-hmm. And so you would have some extraterrestrials, non-Earth beings, that perhaps would come from places much more like Earth and maybe even look like us.
I think that in the evolutionary process that nature has clearly, nature on Earth, has a clear idea of how to evolve a higher, more efficient, surviving organism. And becoming biped upright, and the taller you are, the farther you see, for example, an ability to turn your head in one way or another, or raise it or lower it, a characteristic which only one insect shares with us, and that's the praying mantis. All of these things do lead to greater likelihood of survival, propagation, and thriving. So when I look at, for example, mammalian life forms on Earth, and having studied biology at a pre-med level and cut open, you know, pigs, sharks, everything from nematodes to sharks, pigs, and sheep and things like that, there is a consistent idea in nature, starting with a spinal column, undulation, then animation, uprightness. Even a snake tries to stand up. We've all seen the cobra stand up in those dances, for example, in Thailand, where they revere the cobra, and women in particular go and kiss the head of the cobra. So everything tries to be more upright, to see farther. And so I think that this is in the genetic structure of life. And since the building blocks are all over the solar system and raining down on everything, I think that the combinations and recombinations of this seem to have, if not direction, an intention from within. Right? That's the way I would describe it.
Sort of all linked by a common consciousness, maybe.
Well, the consciousness is another interesting idea.
All right, hang on. We have to take this break, and we'll be back.
Okay, sure.
All right, folks, we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and for those of you just joining us now in this second hour, welcome. I'm glad you're here. my sympathy to you for whatever it is that kept you away from that first hour, and my most sincere hopes, prayers, dreams, wishes that you never suffer such a tragedy again. My guest this evening is Robert Morningstar, and he is editor of UFO Digest. We're talking about a report that came out actually a couple of years ago and didn't get much play in the press, a report from NASA that walks right up to saying that there is life on Titan, but then backs away. Well, that's typical for NASA. NASA always backs away from the facts and in public statements. It's a mystery. That's a mystery to me, and one that I delve into quite frequently here, and I think have shown you extensive evidence that that's the case. Well, this is a report from NASA about Titan. Titan is one of the moons of Saturn, and a few years ago, I forget what year it was in, but a few years ago, we landed a probe on Titan. It was called the Huygens probe. The Cassini mission launched that probe, and it went over and landed on Titan. Took pictures all the way down. Took pictures once it was down. That was pretty interesting. And Cassini has continued to fly around the Saturn system, and once in a while goes by Titan and does some more photographs and spectral analysis. Well, they came out with this report now a couple of years ago indicating that they described a biological process taking place, but they won't admit it's biological. And then they say, well, it may be some sort of a chemical process. I said earlier, if it were chemical, chemistry, every chemical reaction either emits energy or ingests energy, and that'll show up in your infrared analysis. Every chemical reaction, if there's a reaction, every chemical reaction emits energy or it ingests, takes in energy. So it gives off heat or it takes in heat, one or the other. So if it takes in heat, then what's happening is the area around it gets colder. If it gives off heat, then of course the area around it gets warmer. And that that chemical reaction will show up in a pretty simple infrared analysis. And this report, Robert, does not mention, it mentions spectral, but it does not mention the infrared analysis, does it?
Right.
Well, see, they avoided that.
Maybe not. They suggest that Cassini is going to make seven more approaches, so maybe that's on the drawing board. But if I could return to this paragraph, I read one part of it regarding the other material, which appears to be organic compound.
Yeah.
But I'd like to read the rest so then we can discuss what may be going on and what they may be missing over here at NASA. The first thing I want to say before I read this is that the solid matter composing the surface of Titan is rock hard solid water at 290 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. The surface is made of ice. Okay, so there is an abundant source of water. The problem is all the energy in that water is locked up in an ice crystal form. So here's the sentence, quote, "In addition, Cassini spectrometer detected an absence of water ice on the Titan surface, but loads of benzene and another material which appears to be an organic compound that scientists have not yet been able to identify. The findings lead scientists to believe that the organic compounds are shellacking over the water ice that makes up the Titan's bedrock with a film of hydrocarbons at least a few millimeters to centimeters thick, but possibly much deeper in some places. The ice remains covered up even as liquid methane and ethane flow all over Titan's surface and fill up lakes and seas much as liquid water does on Earth." While we were having the break, Okay, here we go. Titan's atmospheric chemistry is cranking out. That's a pretty big statement for NASA. Cranking out organic compounds that rain down on the surface so fast that even as streams of liquid methane and ethane at the surface wash the organics off, the ice quickly gets quickly covered again. All that implies Titan is a dynamic place where organic chemistry is happening now. It occurred to me while we were off the, in the break, that what they're describing is kind of like a blanket of organic material that's constantly being formed on the surface over the water, over the hard water, then being washed away by the benzene, the ethane, and the methane, liquid methane. And it occurred to me that this thing that they describe as several millimeters to centimeters to possibly much deeper in some places sounds very much to me like how I would describe moss or a fungus spreading over a surface. And this word that they use, shellacking, which as in, I'm going to give you a good shellacking, there's pretty powerful vocabulary being used here to describe this, what all of us should say are life processes. But again, their extreme caution and scientific conservatism keeps them from calling a spade a spade.
They're homo terracentrism.
They don't know a hawk from a handsaw.
Well, you said let's take a look at this paragraph and see perhaps what is it that NASA's lacking or missing. What they are lacking and missing is the ability to be open, honest, and transparent with the public.
What occurred to me that I said they might be missing is that they are saying quite explicitly that these organic compounds are being spread all over the surface of solid water, okay?
Mm-hmm.
This unbelievably hard ice. Now, what happens to ice when you put a blanket over it? Even if the surface outside is 290 degrees below zero, if you put a blanket, you remember the scene in The Thing when they put the blanket over the ice cube and the thing melts out?
Yeah.
Let me use that analogy about this huge blanket over the surface of Titan, covering all this potentially liquid water, but they also hypothesize and assert that there's a lot of heat rising up out of the core of Titan, and that it may be erupting in cryovolcanoes which emit liquid water. So I'm saying that if this heat source is present on Titan and radiating upward through its mantle or whatever it would be, water, it would be the mantle, with a blanket of this organic material, the surface just below the organic material could be melted by a chemical interaction that could be producing a minute amount of liquid water to facilitate the formation of this organic compound or this organism. That's the next stage up, right? We've got organic compounds, and then if it starts to propagate and reproduce or continue, then we have organism rather than just organic compounds.
Yeah.
I think much attention should be paid to that.
Now, there is also another possibility. One of the things that I've been doing while you've been talking is showing a picture that I used in that show, within the same week that Huygens landed and those pictures started coming back, the black and white shots, that it took on its way down. They came back, in a matter of a few minutes, from Huygens, but they within that first week they began to release some of these, and I've been showing a picture that I used. Now, we started out with you telling us these amazing documents about these amazing documents, a report from these astronomers who were working under the CIA to track some motherships that had been observed that had taken up position in orbit around Earth back in the 1940s. And their report was that they originated from or have a base on Titan. Now, I had not heard that, frankly. I had not heard that until you and I talked on the phone earlier this week. But the picture that I've been showing is a picture that I used back then and have used a number of times since. Robert, this picture, it's black and white. I showed it to two commercial airline pilots. And what I did is I zoomed in on one particular area of the picture. And it's kind of blurry. And I told them, I said, look, this is an aerial photo. It's a little bit blurry. But can you tell me? I didn't tell them that it was not on Earth. I said, can you tell me what you're looking at? Now, they were. I didn't do this with them together. I did this separately.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them told me, that's an airstrip. That's a landing strip. And right there is a control tower. And I said, well, the first one, I said, are you sure? And he said, I get paid to look at things from the air. And he said, one of the things that you'd better be able to spot from the air is a place to set your plane down.
Sure.
And he said, yeah, that's a landing strip, and there's the tower. And he said, that's a pretty big landing strip. And so both of them told me it was a landing strip. Now, to me, it does look like construction. I would not have said landing strip because, you know, I'm not a commercial air pilot. But I see exactly what they're talking about. But here's the deal. To the right of that, in that picture, it extends from the coastline right out into the ocean of what NASA says is methane. Okay, now, to the right of that is an island. And on that island is something that looks like very similar to a step pyramid, except the top level appears to be circular, and there appears to be a little bit of a protuberance sticking up, like a perhaps a radar dish. To the right, at the extreme right of that, there is a half-circular area with a big pipe coming out of it. And I mean, frankly, the thing looks like some kind of a factory.
I'd love to see that photo. Would you email it to me?
Sure.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Do some enhancement on it, see what we come up with.
Sure, I'll do that. But it all looks very constructed. So when we put these together with what you told us right at the beginning about these astronomers saying that the motherships originated from or have a base on Titan, is it possible that they do and that they are perhaps subsurface? And if they are, this organic compound may be the sewage coming up out of those places.
Oh, it could be.
Being dumped out on the surface.
Yeah, the other thing about the idea of a methane-based life form, I was talking again before about, you know, old folklore and tradition and, you know, demons and aliens. And the other thing that people have remarked on is that some aliens really stink, and that's what I would expect from a methane-based life form. That one element, the cold, and the other one is the dreadful smell of these creatures that drives people into panic. You know, like smelling Bigfoot, which they associate with hydrogen sulfoxide, which if you smell that gas, it'll put you into a swoon, and you pass out and have out-of-body experiences. So this the scent of the alien is also something that you know, would be consistent with a methane-based life form.
Well,
I was joking to a friend earlier, you know, about this, and you know, the alien comes over and says to me, "Take me to your leader," and I pinch my nose, point that way. Is that me? It's him, President Obama. He's the leader. Go to him.
Well, how likely do you think it is that there is intelligent life? I mean, based on what those astronomers said, and based on what I just described in this picture, provided, I know you haven't seen the picture, but provided that I've described it accurately,
sure.
How likely do you think it is that Titan is a base for intelligent extraterrestrials? How likely is that?
To be honest with you, I think that this is a stepping stone in the revelation from NASA of this the existence or the presence of this life form. And the other thing that I want to bring back to our recollection was the important announcement that was made at the University of Arizona about a year and a half, or maybe it's 2 years ago, where they described the discovery of an arsenic-based life form in Mono Lake, California. Do you recall that?
Yeah, there's been a big uproar about that.
Oh, right. Well, what is the standard methodology of debunking from the CIA? Attack the person, attack the material, attack the methodology, and that's where they went after these people, attacking their methodology, claiming that they contaminated their own sample. But the important thing, regardless of that, was when they had that press conference, I think her name was Naomi Wolf, she said, a life form like this has to struggle here on Earth, but a life form like this on another place, for example, Titan, Saturn's moon Titan, could be viable because the temperature is so much lower there that it could exist long enough to reconstruct itself, to acquire enough arsenic to keep its metabolism going. So that was a big thing. And again, they pointed the finger at Titan during that press conference. And having known this, what I've told you about knowing about the Titan origin or base of extraterrestrials from those Project Sign, Project Grudge reports, I first came across those around 1997 or 98. So when this researcher, the astrobiologist, said Titan, I jumped out of my seat. I said, well, this is another, and this here is another stepping stone going in the same direction. So as I say, you know, the psychological factor is the most important factor, and this has to be very, very delicately treated. Again, hearkening back to the reaction of 1938 and Orson Welles, that is what made them really, really afraid of confronting this in public. So it's a desensitization program to get rid of our fears before they really let out the truth. But it's truth in piecemeal.
I fear these liars a great deal more than I fear the extraterrestrials.
Well, I don't fear either one.
Well, I don't either. But I mean, if I had to give them a grade, I would give...
Our vision is 2020, so...
You know, you've heard me talk about the space-based space surveillance system.
Mm-hmm.
This is a real system. This is not a joke. This is not fiction, folks. Go look it up. Space-based space surveillance. Not space-based Earth surveillance. Space-based space surveillance system.
You're talking about the Deep Space Network?
No.
Oh.
This is system that they began to deploy.
Signals 1.5 billion miles away from Earth in almost every direction.
No, this is a system that they began to deploy a couple of years ago, and they're they were 2 years late then. But this is a system comprised of a minimum of 10 satellites. All 10 of these satellites are super high-powered optical as well as remote sensing satellites. They are pointed into deep space. And the paperwork on them says that their purpose is to track and identify deep space forces for both offensive and defensive operations. And I did a show on that when that first came out, and I said, wait a minute, to track and identify deep space forces? Who's coming?
Yeah.
Who's out there? And so this Titan thing could be part of the answer.
Yep. There's some very interesting stuff going on in the space station. You know, in getting ready for this show, last night I tuned into the NASA cable channel, and I was watching some of the amazing things they're doing. You know, NASA has an interesting thing, a little game they play. They'll throw a tape on with absolutely no audio on it, mm-hmm. no narration, no background noise, nothing, and they'll just run it and show it. And on one occasion, about a year and a half ago, I threw in a tape because they were showing Mars and really fantastic rover pictures from Mars, and some of it looked like video. So I threw in a tape, and about 4 minutes later, I was in utter shock and disbelief as I saw rover camera panning over a sandy surface that had a lot of pools of water. And as the camera pans farther and farther, the pools get bigger and bigger. And then at the very end, before they cut it up in the left corner, there was literally a scene of a beach, which I've told you before. I've joked about it, and I call it Morningstar Beach because mm-hmm. I see it, I saw it, and I named it. But the waves are rolling in on this coast. And the waves, the remarkable thing about this tape is that the way the waves are propagating, the way they're rolling, the way they're cresting, and the way they're breaking, it cannot be Earth, because it's an effect that would be produced by an atmosphere, a different density, and a different gravitational quotient. So it's a pretty remarkable piece of videotape that I have, and I really hope to get this machine that can take a VHS and digitize it so I can put it on YouTube for everyone to see. But it's there.
Well, I have shown pictures from Mars. Actually, the picture I have in mind, it was from the European Space Agency. And it shows a peninsula going out into what is either a gigantic lake, something like our Great Lakes, or mm-hmm. it's going out into the ocean. And you see water and waves beyond that peninsula, and then you see them on this side of it, and buildings all over that peninsula. All right, we have to take a break, and we shall return right after this.
To the Kevin Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Robert, as we went away for break, I was talking about this picture from the ESA showing water on Mars.
Right.
And during the break, I checked to see if I still had that hanging around somewhere, and I do. So for those of you who are watching, here it is. You can see this peninsula sticking out into the water, at the top of your picture, you can see white caps in the water, and there's water beyond that peninsula. And if you folks will just hang on just a moment, I'll zoom in on what I said looks like buildings back there and let you take a look at that, too. All right. So here we go. There you go. All along that peninsula, there looks like construction. And actually, if you follow that construction all the way to the end of the peninsula, there's a beach and big buildings back there. And so let's just do that for folks so they can see.
Sounds like Havasu.
Yeah, I called it the ESA Resort on Mars.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But it's fascinating, and it's a picture I know that you have seen, but perhaps you didn't. It's possible you didn't notice those buildings because you have to zoom in to kind of.
I would be looking more at the water than the buildings. But you know, on this topic, I think it's really a lot of fun to spend time with Joseph Skipper's website.
Oh yeah,
fantastic work. So those of you who want to really explore Mars and lunar anomalies, but he's really concentrated on Mars, and you can see forests, trees, and bushes, and all kinds of remarkable things there. Joseph Skipper's website.
Yeah, that's Mars Anomalies, MarsAnomaliesResearch.com.
Yeah.
And,
good work.
Yeah, it is fascinating. I use a lot of stuff from his website. I wish he would dive into Titan as much as he has Mars, because I think, although I'm not sure, but I think that we would find just as many anomalies on Titan. Although, you know, part of the problem is we just don't have as many pictures.
I was going to say exactly the same thing. There is a paucity of material to be studied there, and I know they've gotten a lot of material there.
Yeah.
Between Cassini and Huygens.
I think there's probably a great deal of material, but a paucity of what has been released to the public. There's probably a great many pictures in possession of NASA that have never been released to the public.
You know, we jump over one planet, over to Jupiter for a second, and start thinking about what we've seen there as well. With the geysers, you know, the geysers of jets that are coming off. Well, first there are, on Io, there are tremendous volcanic activity. Io has a flux tube right down to the planet. When I was reading this story about the hydrogen flow from the upper atmosphere right down to the surface of Titan, it reminded me of this this electromagnetic flux tube that's formed between the moon Io and Jupiter, which is sending vast amounts of energy down into the Jovian atmosphere and whatever lies beneath it. But the image of, I think it's Enceladus, not Enceladus, one of the moons of Jupiter is spewing, it's got volcanoes that are spewing jets of steam and organic material right out into space. And this thing is spinning around Jupiter and spinning around with all of its moons and spreading this stuff all over that area of Jupiter and Saturn. So we're getting pictures of this process where these building blocks of life are literally being sprayed. The gentleman from this Titan project described it as a hose of hydrogen just squirting almost as if it were liquid hydrogen on the surface. So this panspermia idea is very viable, and I see it now represented in all of these images that I've described and you have described as well.
The theory of panspermia has been for a long time, poo-pooed by the great apes of science.
Yeah.
But it is now becoming clear that that's exactly what's happening.
And this idea of panspermia, I'm a bit of a philosopher, too. And I was thinking, you know, one of the things, names for God is simplex or the monad. What if God, in his simplest form, turned out to be simple bacterium that had the potential? It had the potential for all the rest of creation. You know,
you're going to hell now.
Oh boy. I don't think I'll meet any bacteria there.
What? Yeah, probably not. Well, you know, certainly...
It's a germ of life, you know?
Yeah.
Germ of life.
Yeah, certainly there are bacteria that have to be present in order for you to live.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, I think almost all of our drives are probably driven by bacterial colonies, you know? You know, when you feel hungry, you know, you say to yourself, oh, I'm hungry, but the sensation of hunger preceded the awareness of hunger, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that drive is coming from your gut. And there's a lot of bacteria in there asking, hey, bro, you know, where's my meal?
It's lunchtime, guy.
Yeah, get on it.
Yeah. Well, it is a very mind-bending thing for some people. When we talk about things like this, but you know, the fact is, you know, I'm sitting here and people are watching and people are listening and I'm talking to millions of people right now, but this is a collection of quadrillions of tiny little single cells,
right,
that's talking to you folks. And you folks who are listening, you are a collection of quadrillions of little single cells all hanging together and cooperating together, and they make up you. And part of all of that is bacteria. You know, without certain bacteria, you could not digest your food. There's certain bacteria you need in order to live, and in the absence of it, you got a problem. And so the idea that I can, here's where I'm going with that. The idea that I can't survive without some of that bacteria means that that bacteria is the building block for me as a human organism.
It's essential to your life.
Mm-hmm. It's a building block.
Right.
And so if...
In the aftermath of chemotherapy for cancer and treatments like that, one of the worst problems that people have is the killing of all the beneficial bacteria in the alimentary tract.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the great hardships, recovering and restoring that after one has gone through chemotherapy or radiation treatments.
Well, and many of those bacteria could live in the extreme, what we consider to be extreme, environments on these other planets and heavenly bodies. And so if they could live there, perhaps they do. And if they do, then perhaps they are one of the building blocks of what will become, complex life. And furthermore, maybe they have, and there is complex life there that evolved within that context and does not consider those conditions to be extreme.
Well, you know, the DNA of a bacteria or humans or all of us is packed with what they loosely call junk DNA. Mm-hmm. And it's turning out that the junk DNA is one of the primary factors in the ability of DNA to transform itself, to adapt, to mutate. And so there's a lot yet to be learned about what we're made of. You know, the 10% that distinguishes us from the other mammals. But the 90% that we hold in common with all other living things, that's remarkable stuff. And it is also what makes us able to adapt to changing conditions. So
then we're mutants, huh?
Viable creatures.
Are we mutants? Are we X-Men?
And we were talking about consciousness before, and we didn't really get into the concept or the idea of a...
Now, okay, before we get into that, I ask you a question.
And which is?
Robert, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. I asked you a question. Does that mean, then, what you said about DNA, and it's the junk DNA that is necessary for us, our DNA, to adapt and to mutate and morph and so forth, does that mean, then, that we are X-Men, that we are mutants?
I believe so. Exactly. That we are able to change some some people's DNA, I think, can react more rapidly than others, and that we have that adaptability. I think healing is one aspect of it. I think that the fact that we suffer unbelievable injuries and that we regenerate skin, we seal wounds, we have scars that restore their hermetic seal in our bodies, I think that's all part of it. And keeping your DNA young is part of longevity. And that's another aspect of, more of the Taoist research and work that I've done over years. But stress de-stresses your DNA. And so remaining calm and learning how to be well-nourished and maintain physical balance and taking the stresses out of your life will also improve your the quality of your DNA. You won't damage it.
And dance every chance you get.
Exactly.
Yeah.
As I said, I would be dancing on December 22nd after the end of time. But it's been a very interesting experience, this end of time experience. And I'm really glad that we went through it.
Well, now seriously...
Yeah.
Quite seriously, we were privileged to celebrate something, and everybody was focused on, oh my God, the end of time. But we were privileged to celebrate something that no one living on this planet had ever celebrated.
Right.
Okay, and that is Bakhtun. And no one at the next Bakhtun, there's no one living now that will be living then at the next Bakhtun.
Right.
So
I was actually being serious myself, because I was very cognizant of the moment when this was happening, mm-hmm. and I was doing Tai Chi and doing the form and that whole idea. This little molecule of man is dropping through the galactic center at this period in time, and I'm privileged not only to be going through it, but to be aware of it, that I'm going through it. And I did feel that the end of time, as I referred to it, it's a psychological change that I myself have gone through.
All right, we'll come back to that right after this break. Ladies and gentlemen, we will be back right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those who are watching, yes, I did take my hat off. It's getting warm in here. So if you've never seen me without my hat, welcome to the magic. Robert, as we went away for break, you had mentioned about being active in Tai Chi, and we know this. You've talked to us about this before. But now I've got a very serious question I want to ask you, and it may turn out that it sounds foolish, but I'm quite serious about this. With Tai Chi, isn't that about sort of really being in tune with the energies and forces of nature?
Absolutely. The first goal of Tai Chi is to become rooted And that means not just planting yourself, but aligning your whole skeleton on the perfect vertical so that your feet are grounded in the center of the earth.
Okay, now here's a question.
Yeah.
If you can tune in to all that energy and the forces here on this planet, would it be possible for you to aim that at Titan and see if you get anything?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting proposal because I have had success with that with the moon. Last January, I had a four-week course at the Edgar Cayce Institute in remote viewing, and on the last one, five of us journeyed. We practiced for 4 weeks to make a journey consciously, and on the last night, we actually got out there, and the responses of the people, of their experiences, the reports of the experiences, were remarkable, including my own, which we can go into another time. But yes, you know what? I'm going to take you up on that. I think it's a really good idea.
Obviously, you and I are not going to ever be able, as far as I can see, to get into a spaceship and go there and see for ourselves, either to the moon or to Titan or to Mars or Mercury.
Mm-hmm.
But folks like you, you're a Tai Chi master, are you not?
I am acknowledged as a Tai Chi master by the highest ranking masters in China, the Hong Kong Tai Chi Masters Association, and many masters here in the United States.
Okay. As a Tai Chi master, with now remote viewing training as well.
Well, you know what? I had the gift, but Tai Chi amplified it. That's what I found. I kind of got into Tai Chi as a result of psychic research and exploration, and then I found that the Chinese had been developing what we used to call ESP for thousands of years, and that Tai Chi was one of the most powerful vehicles for developing the skills. So, yes, it's a very, very useful instrument.
Well, listen, when you do that...
Physically, we can. Listen, you brought back to my mind, to memory,
mm-hmm.
a turning point in my life was seeing the climax of 2001, A Space Odyssey, in 1969. And at that time, I was really psyched. I was in Army ROTC, then Air Force ROTC, and I wanted to be an astronaut. And when the Star Child was born in 2001, A Space Odyssey, this inner voice said to me, "Yeah, Robert, you can get there, but you can't get there in a rocket ship."
You told us that one time. I remember you telling him about that.
I went into psychology, and as it was telling me that it's inner space. You can get there through inner space. It's much more difficult through outer space. But all space is connected. All space is connected.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you do this experiment or whatever we should call it, and you kind of aim at Titan, after you do that, will you come back here and tell us the results?
I'd love to do that. And then at the same time, I'll describe to you some of the experiences that we had in this remote viewing class where we targeted the moon.
Did you actually go to the moon in this remote viewing?
Yeah. You know, I'm not the first one. You know, as a matter of fact, C.G. Jung relates that in 1944, he almost died. He received an antibiotic shot, and he almost died. He was dying in the doctor's office, and his soul left the body. He went into outer space, and he could see the Earth, and this description that he gave of the planet Earth from outer space was not appreciated until the Apollo astronauts were on their way to the moon and took the first color photos of Earth on their way. And when they compared that photo with the description of Jung in his out-of-body experience, leaving the Earth, dying, he went to the moon, and he went into a cave in the moon, and he saw what he described as a short Hindu man, a short, bald Hindu man came up to him and said, "No, you can't come in yet." And he said, "No, I've wanted to know this all of my life. I've been working all my life. I have to get in. I want to see what's there." And they said, "No, you've got to go back. It's not your time. You have great work to do." And then this interaction was going with the little, dark,
called Hindu man, as he described him, which I think was an ET. He said that he had a doctor trying to revive him, and he didn't want to be revived. He wanted to stay dead, go into the moon.
Mm-hmm.
So the doctor revives him with a shot of adrenaline, and Jung was outraged. He was so angry that he wouldn't talk to the doctor for 2 weeks. You can read that story in Jung and the Life of Our Times by Lawrence Vanderpost, who wrote Bushmen of the Kalahari.
Wow.
I cherish C.G. Jung. He was really, he was the greatest psychologist of the 20th century. Unfortunately, we've been led by the Pied Pipers of Freudianism in the wrong direction, and the result is Sandy Hook, Aurora, and a demented psychology and psychiatry that rules the nation today. That's a topic for another time.
Well, this has been fascinating. You know, I've got to say that, you know, I haven't done any more shows since I did two or three shows on Titan. The first one being right after we landed there. But then, I've done a couple of others. And then I haven't done any more. And, I haven't because there really didn't seem to be much of interest coming out of there. You brought this report to my attention, and it is one that, frankly, I do remember when it came out, but I also remember I had sort of ho-hum attitude because I didn't read the report. I just saw what the news reported. And
well, what I saw was remarkable. Those paragraphs that I read to you and reinterpreted in my vocabulary, they were fascinating. And all I have to say, the silence was deafening.
Yeah.
The idea that this report could come out, and it's not just one paper, it's two papers that came out back to back, and that it was totally ignored by media. As I said, the silence is deafening, and I'm really glad that I brought it to your attention and that we have had this opportunity to discuss it.
Well, I am too. If you will, Robert, stay on the line with me because as I bring this program in for a landing, after we do that, I would like to talk with you for a minute or two on the telephone. Ladies and gentlemen, we live in an exciting time, and we live in an exciting universe. There are people working overtime right now to keep you from knowing that. And to the best of my ability, I'm working overtime to make sure you do know about it. And this is part, tonight's show is part of achieving that goal. We open every show by saying, I'm here because you have a right to know, and you matter. Well, you do have a right to know. And unfortunately, the people who should be telling you aren't. So thanks to Robert Morningstar for being one of the people who is willing to step up and help keep us informed. And thank you for being here. I'll do my best to keep bringing you the information and keep you informed. As I said, we live in exciting times, and we live in a very exciting universe. Don't forget to click that join button and become a member here at the Kevin Smith Show to make sure that we are still here tomorrow. My friends call me Steel Eye, my enemies do too, and you may call me whatever you'd like to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long everybody.